Today's Teisho is on case 19 in the Book of Serenity. Case 19 is entitled Yunmen's Sumeru. Introduction. I always admire the novel devices of Yunmen. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? Try to discern. Case. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. Verse. Commentary. National teacher Yuan Tong Shan said, this case is debated everywhere. Some say as soon as one questions in this way, already this is raising a thought, a fault as big as Mount Sumeru. Some say it is like Mount Sumeru, unmoved by the eight winds, remaining steadfast for 1,000 years. Some say that because it is difficult for people to pass through, it is like Mount Sumeru. Such assessments have not yet comprehended Yunmen's meaning. Only if the bottom of the bucket has fallen out and the red thread is broken off will you realize it. Not at all. Verse. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get hold. The blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as a tip of a hair in there. A phony cock crow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate of confusion. So this is the final day of our August session. And what a difference, right? 2 days ago, it was a swamp in the dormitory. It was 90-some degrees, and the humidity was very oppressive. And today, it's cool, low humidity, beautiful. But, you know, these transformations are nothing, you know, compared to the changes in people's minds. You know, so I definitely think it's the case that the people who came here with one set of attitudes are leaving in a very different mental state. And this is the beauty of Sesshin, which is made possible by the amazing self-purifying nature of the mind. So I want to thank everybody for doing such an excellent job, working so hard, and we still have hours of sitting ahead, so please continue to do that. But it is just quite striking to see when people come into the Dokusan room, the transformation in 5 days. Basically, people have been willing to open themselves up wholeheartedly to the process of the Sesshin, and to have put themselves at risk. You know, when you go through Sesshin, you know, basically you're willing to place yourself in a vulnerable position, right? You're having to confront these obstacles in yourself, to face them, and there's no guarantee, right? You know, once you open the door, there's no guarantee that you can control what comes out, and there's no guarantee that you can resolve the issue. So it takes a great deal of courage just to come to Sesshin, and it takes a great deal of courage to go through that process. And I'm happy to report no fatalities. Everybody seems to be in good shape. As I've said before, you know, it's so typical. It's so typical that after a couple days, people are feeling very tired. Their muscles hurt, and they're really low often. Not always, but it's often the case that, you know, on the second day of Sesshin or the morning of the third day, you know, that's when people jump in their cars and drive away, typically because they're at sort of this emotional low point. And then the next day, you know, people come in and the end of day three, they're happy, everything is beautiful. This is an amazing, Sesshin is an amazing process. And I thank you all for practicing so wholeheartedly, allowing the process to work. You know, so I don't need to tell you that. Let me just say, there's something pretty amazing about the mind. You know, the Sesshin shows that there's something amazing about the mind. That if we just go through this process, the mind starts cleaning itself up. It starts working through its obstacles. You know, the interesting thing is that you can't be your own therapist, and you can't be your own Zen teacher. You can't be your own therapist because you can't get out of your own mental habits to see them from an exterior perspective. So people who are deeply neurotic, for example, often don't allow themselves to see that they're deeply neurotic. People who have, you know, you can just go through one disorder after another. People conceal their they conceal their problems, or they rationalize their behavior. So, you know, if somebody has a narcissistic personality disorder, such as our president, for example, you know, that person tends to become angry very quickly whenever anybody calls into question their identity. This is like a classic of a psychotherapy, you know. So when people, this is called a narcissistic injury. So you will meet people who, if you just say the wrong thing to them, they just blow up in your face, right? It's like, and when they blow up in their face, it's really like out of proportion to what you did. Those people have. Feel deeply threatened when anything doesn't confirm their sort of imaginary image of themselves. This is why, by the way, our president gets so angry when people ask him difficult questions. He always turns it into a personal attack on the questioner. And by the way, our governor used to do this too. He still does. You know? But when they have a press conference and people pitch a hard question or a question that should make the governor uncomfortable, he blasts the speaker. He says, you know, you're a typical, you know, journalist, you're blah, blah, blah. And he really runs the person down or tries to shout him down. And it's not just a political tactic. He feels deeply threatened by anybody who calls into question his image of himself. And the thing is that, you know, I've met people with this disorder in other walks of life. You know, I once worked for a dean who was like this. And, I had written a report. When I got to Rutgers, I wrote a report about the failing remedial program at Rutgers. I had just arrived, and I was hired to do a job. And I gathered all these data, and I noticed that all of these students were being admitted to Rutgers, remedial students. That is, they didn't have the necessary math or English skills to succeed. And we were admitting them, but they were failing out in very large numbers, and nobody had actually studied the numbers to see their success rate. So I wrote a report up, and I said, you know, we have like a 65% attrition rate. And I sent it around, and I went to meet with this dean. And the dean was deep, this was not, did not have anything to do with this dean's responsibilities. So the report was not an attack on anything he was in charge of. But when I came in and talked to him, he was so hostile. And he actually said to me, this actually happened. He said, this is fine. But if you ever make me look bad, you know, I'm going to fry your ass, basically. It was like that. And I was like, what? You know, I just gotten out of graduate school, right? And so, wow. You know, so I didn't go to see that dean very often, you know. But he was so threatened by, you know, in other words, that's somebody with a narcissistic personality disorder. And, you know, if you ask that dean what he's like, he'd say, oh, I'm a wonderful guy. You know, I'm patient, I'm calm. I do tend to get upset with people who are jerks, you know, or something. So they rationalize it, right? That person can't be his own therapist. And it's also true in a certain way that that you can't be your own Zen teacher. I'm not making a pitch for me. You know, you can study in any tradition you want, but I'm just saying, you know, you can't really see your obstacles on your own. So if you get up every day and you do a half an hour of meditation, you are calming the mind, you are entering samadhi, but you are not working through your obstacles. You know, in order to work through your obstacles, you need to come to sesshin. And if you just sit on the cushion, say you've had a bad day at work and somebody's insulted you, and you have been unjustly accused, let's say, and you're upset, and you come home and you sit down on the cushion, and you reach a samadhi state where you're calm, that's positive, that's wonderful. But it still doesn't necessarily solve the deep root or resolve the deep-rooted problems. You know, so, you know, when you come to sesshin, you really start struggling with those deep problems. There's just nothing like it. But I'm not a therapist, and Zen is different from therapy, but there is something, there's something in both cases which is really interesting. And that is that, you know, the good therapist actually lets the mind heal itself. And the good Zen teacher is actually letting the mind guide the student, you know. So you know, a therapist who already has, you know, like a system worked out, you know, is probably not a very good therapist. The good therapist, I think, is somebody who just keeps prodding the patient to deal with contradictions in things that she says or things that he says. And, you know, the therapist doesn't know where this is going, necessarily. It's not like the therapist has it all mapped out. The therapist is just bringing to the person's attention contradictions, and then the person herself or himself begins to get better, begins to work them through. And it's very similar in Zen training. It's a very similar process. There are people who, you know, the good Zen teacher is just orchestrating the process. So, you know, the koans are these amazing, amazing teaching tools. And you give somebody a koan, and somebody actually came in and said, you know, I was working with this koan, and it involved just saying one word, you know, and now I'm working with this koan, and I just sang one word, and it's a world of difference, right? That's amazing, right? These koans trigger unconscious responses. And by the way, you know, these koans were written, you know, they were compiled in the 12th century. And they were, you know, written in China, you know. And yet when you use them with American students, they're highly effective. I think that's just amazing. In fact, you know, there are some koans that require particular responses from the student, including like physical responses. And these koans were written, you know, what, 800 years ago or something, right? And yet, you know, you get the right response. It's like, how is that possible? I'll leave that question for you to ponder, you know. But the point is, you know, the koan is like a trigger. It's you give it to the student internalizes it, like a mantra. And mantras are somewhat similar. You know, mantra affects you on an unconscious level. You know, on an unconscious level. They, you know, something like Om doesn't, Om, you know, Mani Padme Om doesn't really make much sense, right? But if you internalize it, it has all of these consequences psychologically. And the koans work the same way. You know, they trigger all this these responses from the deep, you could say, deep unconscious mind. It's not something I can control or foresee. So, you know, everybody is going to give a different answer, even though it's true that there's this uniformity. It's also true that everybody's answer comes out of their own life history. Right, you're bringing your own life to bear on the koan. So everybody's response to the koan is going to be a little different. You know, there's going to be all of these personal nuances. Now let me just say that it's not all subjective, because, you know, when you get a koan, it's true that each person is bringing her life experience to the koan, but there is a general direction. The koan is going in like a general direction. So I can see, you know, I can see if you're just wildly off, or if you're moving in, if you're working with the koan. And if you're wildly off, I can just say, no, you're wildly off, or I think that's too intellectual. And if you're working in the right direction, I'll say, oh, good, good, you know, keep going. And that means you're really letting the koan take you somewhere. You know, working with a koan is like you let the koan initiate a process that's like, this is opening up and opening up and opening up. And you don't know where it's going, and I'm not controlling the process either. You know, I'm just helping you to keep it open until there's some kind of a resolution. And the resolution will mean the return of the experience of a bigger wholeness, you could say, bigger wholeness. So, you know, koans usually lead you through an experience of your own, some contradiction in yourself or some painful event or some thing that you've never, some karmic, you could say, karmic contradiction or karmic injury, and leads you through that, and you have to go through it. It can be very painful and very difficult, but on the other end, you achieve this bigger wholeness. You know, so when a teacher gives you a koan, you get stuck. That's the purpose of the koan. You know, if I gave you a koan, blah blah blah, and then you answered the, you know, blah blah blah. And then I gave you another koan, you answered blah, 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 okay, I gave you another. That would be a disaster, right? If you answered every koan like this, 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 that's a disaster, right? The koan is supposed to stick in your craw, right? It's supposed to bug you in order to help you liberate yourself, right? It's supposed to be difficult. You know, Mumon said it's like swallowing a hot iron ball. You can't fully swallow it, you can't spit it out. It's a kind of a unpleasant metaphor. Hakuin said those vile koans, right? So you know, nobody wants to, you know, we bury this stuff very carefully, right? You know, when you know, so the narcissist says, oh no, I'm a wonderful guy, everybody loves me. And then they have a big enemies list, right, you know. Or people who have phobias, you know, they never, you know, I had a friend who used to, he had a phobia. When he would drive over a long bridge, he would start shaking. And every summer he would have to drive down across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, and he couldn't do it. He had to have ask his wife to drive because he would just, his phobia was so powerful. And, you know, he was telling me about this, and I said, well, so what are you going to do about it? And he said, do about it? Nothing. You know, I just get my wife to drive the car. Yeah, well, that solves the problem. You know, there was something so terrifying in that uncertainty that he couldn't drive a car. But, he, you know, it's like, oh, no, everything's fine. I have her drive, you know. So we all do that, right? So the koan opens us up. It takes us down into these regions, these things we've closed. We find out why we can't drive across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, you know. And usually that stuff is very difficult to work with. But on the other end, you know, there's this bigger wholeness, you know, bigger wholeness. So this is a process, right, that involves, it's a little like psychoanalysis. It involves working with the big mind. And this is, you know, there's a little difference, though, between, like, psychoanalysis and Zen, because, you know, some psychologists believe that the mind has a wisdom, has an inherent self-healing property. But many of them don't, you know. Many people don't look at it that way. Like Freud, he didn't believe that the mind was, that the unconscious mind was a good place. For him, it was like a haunted house full of ghosts and so on. But we Zen people don't feel that way. You know, we believe that at the core of your consciousness is Buddha nature. And you already have enlightened mind. We have just lost track of it. We've covered it up, you know. So, you know, basically this thing happened to you and you closed a door in yourself. And this thing happened to you and you closed a door in yourself. And this thing happened to you and you closed a door in yourself. Pretty soon, you know, you've got all these doors closed and you're safe, but you're in this very tiny little world, right? You know, you know, Zen says that behind all those doors there's this enlightened intelligence, and it's trying to help you all the time, day and night. This is what Zen people believe. You know, there's an enlightened being inside of you, and he is you, or she is you, and it's trying to get you out of your traps. But we are so afraid, or we're so caught, you know, we don't necessarily trust the existence of that. There are many people, if you say, you know, fundamentally people are enlightened, they think that's impossible. But if you start working with that intelligence, you start confronting the contradictions, it kicks this deeper intelligence into gear. And it starts, it's like we're working from both ends, right? In one of the koans, it talks about a mother hen trying to help the chick get out of the egg. The chick is trapped in the egg, and the chick is pecking from inside, and the mother hen is pecking from outside. Well, your big mind is inside, it's pecking its way out to help you, and you're pecking your way with your koan down into big mind. So you're tunneling, you're both moving in the same direction. And you come together when you resolve your koan. Yeah, you know, basically, all of the work that happens on the cushion is unconscious. It's unconscious. You know, what does this have to do with the koan? A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? So You know, we know that when we're in deep samadhi, we don't have so many thoughts, and sometimes we have a thoughtless state, right? And so the question is, when we're in deep samadhi and we're in a thoughtless state, is it still possible to make a mistake, or is it still possible to be wrong or be at fault? See, and Yunmen says, Sumeru, Sumeru. This is the mountain that is at the center of the universe, or our universe. Sumeru. And you think, well, what does that have, what does that mean? Well, basically, we are, another, he could have also said, iceberg. See where this is going? In other words, he could have said, we live on the tip of the iceberg. We worry about being at fault or not at fault. We worry about this and we worry about that. Our conscious minds are so thin and insubstantial and easily distracted and fearful and clinging, etc. But underneath that thin film is this giant mind, Sumeru, right? So inside you is a Sumeru of wisdom, see? And we live on like the top of Sumeru, and we don't even know it's a mountain, right? We just think we're locked in our little room and we're worried about, this and that, but meanwhile, we're living on this giant mountain. So he could have said, iceberg. You're just looking at the tip of the iceberg. Under the surface is this giant mind. And, if you're practicing mu koan, you're learning how to access this. When we sit down on the cushion and we call mu and our minds become blank, this is such an important event. We ordinary people believe that the whole world is made up of, is the world our consciousness has access to. So ordinary people have, they've heard about the unconscious. They think it's Freudian slip, something like that. They have these ideas about the unconscious. But they don't realize that most of our life takes place at the unconscious level. And consciousness is just this thin film. See, but we live because we overemphasize the discriminating mind and the conscious mind. We live in this tiny little world where things upset us that are really quite ridiculous, right? I don't want to bring up Trump again, but, the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and he's upset if somebody, says he's gained weight or something and tries to attack them in his tweets, It's like, meanwhile, the planet is heating up, we're going to go to war with North Korea, et cetera, but he's upset about, somebody said his tie wasn't nice or something, and he's launching personal attacks on them. So this is the conscious mind, right? This is the conscious mind. And we spend our lives fretting about this and that, fretting away. And, my father was worked for the government. And in the government, as in so many places, there's a hierarchy. So you probably still the case, I'm sure, that you get what's called a government rank. So it's a G, government service something. So, if you're a postman, you might be a government service 4 or 5, something like that. And everybody gets a rating. In the government service, at least when my father was in it, once you got to be a 13, you were in what are called the super ranks, super grades. So my father was a 12, And my father wanted so much to be a 13, and he couldn't make it, and he felt like a failure. You know, it was like, you know, he used to look at these people who were GS 14s or 15s like they lived on Mount Olympus, right? Like, oh my God, those people have really made it. And my father, you know, felt like a failure. It's over, you know, this isn't trivial. I mean, it's over a number, right? You know, so when you die, you can put on your stone, if you have a stone, you know, I made it to GS 14, right? And you can imagine some anthropologist or archaeologist 1,000 years from now finding this stone and say, what could that mean? You know, I have no idea, you know. I mean, it doesn't matter. You know, it's inconsequential. And you can say, well, but I would have made another $300 a month, or I would have made, you know, or I would have had a bigger office, and an office with a window, you know. Really? Is that what your life is about? Really? So I saw my father torment himself over this, you know. Meanwhile, you know, getting older, and then, you know, in his misery, you know, he got cancer, and he died at 69. And, you know, there were all these things he never did with his life. You know, it's just like this life spent in resentment and regret, you know. You know, my father could have gone to Hawaii. He never went to Hawaii. You know, my father went on a business trip to Athens for the government. And I said, Dad, did you go to see the Acropolis? He said, no, I had too much to do. I stayed in my hotel. It's like, oh, wow, okay. You mean you didn't go to see the Parthenon? You know, okay. You know, and, you know, so fine. You know, I mean, that is a sad case, right? But we all have a tendency to be like that, right? That if we live on the thin film of consciousness. But, you know, Zen is about learning how to activate your deeper mind. To get back to Sumeru, the Sumeru, which is your real nature. And when you call Mu, and you get to this blank place, that is like the door to Sumeru. It's the door into your big mind. Now, you know, when you look at that blankness, it's never going to change. Its character is never going to change, because when the little mind, the small mind, looks at the big mind, all it ever sees is blankness or darkness. It never sees anything else. Because the little mind can't grasp the big mind. That's all. It just seems like no input, see. But when we call Mu, you know, we're actually learning how to activate or access the big mind. And we don't access it intellectually, we access it in a different way. But it's the energy you feel is the beginning of the activation of the big mind. So when we go in and we call Mu, it's not just some crazy idea, it's just not some crazy ritual. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're facing that blankness. I want to see if you can get your intellectual self out of the way and let the voice of Sumeru fill the room. And you know, there's, you know, people feel very self-conscious when they think about having to go in and call Mu. And so, you know, that makes it even worse. But at some point, you know, people let go. They trust the process enough to just open their mouths and let it come out. And sometimes it's very pure. You know, it's a very pure manifestation of Sumeru. So that's what we're up to with that crazy calling Mu. You know, can you get out of your own way? Can you take your discriminating, thinking, small self-mind, put it away, and open yourself up to Sumeru energy? And there's degrees to which this can be done. You know, so some people can do this a little bit, and some people can do this a lot, and some people can do this a lot. And it's not a matter of talent or potential. You can just keep cultivating your mu mind and deepening your experience of your sumeru. And that's what koan training is all about, learning how to access that and learning how to live. You know, right now maybe you live 1% of your life under the surface with sumeru. Maybe it's 10. But eventually, you know, you could live much of your life on this deeper level and actually much less of your life on the small mind level. And that's really a good thing, actually, to live from a different place. We say heart mind, to live from the heart mind. You know, this deep, in Chinese it's shin. In Japanese is kokoro. You know, the heart, living from, heart is not a sentimental idea. It's a unified mind in accord with the way. And what does that mean? It means you can act, you live, you act from and live from your sumeru mind. So, you know, getting to the sumeru mind is a challenge. Because, you know, we have all of these locked doors and we have to keep unlocking the doors. And eventually, you know, you open the doors and you look out and you see this great mountain. And that is who you really are. So, everybody today, yesterday, and in the preceding days was unlocking the doors. And some of you came on Friday night and much can be done. You know, this is day two, usually a very hard day. But in that in those moments when you're thinking, why did I come here? You know, my legs are really hurting, I'm really tired. That's when you can open up, you know, something can happen and you can open up to your bigger mind. So we have many hours left in the day. We have hours left in the day. So please continue to practice with diligence and cultivate your sumeru mind.